Hindsight 2020, debriefing the last 3 years. A day of special programming looking back at the Trump regime, what happened, why, and the repercussions domestically and internationally. We'll focus on national policy, foreign policy, privacy and surveillance, policing, immigration, labor rights, confronting white nationalism, the environment, and much more. Again, that's Hindsight 2020, debriefing the last 3 years on Tuesday, January 21st from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. here on your community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Not So Supernova on Saturday, January 18th from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at the All Saints Episcopal Church in Portland. Not So Supernova is a full-length one-woman play exploring the edges of motherhood and marriage with humor and depth. Again, that's Not So Supernova on Saturday, January 18th from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at the All Saints Episcopal Church, 4033 Southeast Woodstock Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, fallout from the disastrous defeat in the UK for the Labour Party. They lost disastrously to the Conservative Tory Party. What are the lessons to be learned not only in the UK, but for the upcoming US presidential election and for our weekly Earth Watch? First Nations people in British Columbia face off with TC Energy. This company wants to move natural gas to the coast where a liquefied natural gas plant will be built. And the Women's March in Los Angeles and across the nation takes place this coming Saturday. And the Reverend William Barber, one of the joint coordinators of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, will be in Southern California, specifically in the Inland Empire. And our guests are Sam Weinstein, who is active with the Camden branch of Momentum, based in the UK. He is in London. Also, Molly Wickham, who is a Klan member with connections with the Wet'suwet'en Nation, who are up against fighting yet another pipeline. Also, Gina Belafonte, who is executive director of Sankofa.org, a social justice organization. Emiliana Gureka, who is with the Women's March Foundation Los Angeles. Also, the Bishop Emery B. James. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandiri. The Senate will transform itself into an impeachment court at noon Eastern Time today. The Constitution calls for Chief Justice John Roberts to preside at the trial, administering the oath to senators who will serve as jurors and swear to deliver impartial justice. In a dramatic procession across the Capitol yesterday, House Democrats carried the formal articles of impeachment against President Trump to the Senate, setting the stage for only the third trial to remove a president in U.S. history. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said Trump violated his oath of office, undermined U.S. national security, and jeopardized the integrity of the country's elections. She defended the one-month wait from the time the House voted to impeach Trump to the vote to transmit the articles of impeachment.
For a long time, I resisted the calls from across the country for impeachment of the president for obvious violations of the Constitution that he had committed. But recognizing the divisiveness of impeachment, I held back. Frankly, I said, this president isn't worth it. But when he acted the way he did in relationship to withholding funds from Ukraine in return for a benefit to him that was personal and political, he crossed a threshold. He gave us no choice.
Trump complained again it was all a hoax, even as fresh details emerged about his efforts in Ukraine. A close associate of President Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, Lev Parnas, claimed that Trump was directly involved in the effort to pressure Ukraine to publicly announce an investigation of Democratic presidential rival Joe Biden and his son Hunter. Lev Parnas says he delivered an ultimatum in May to the incoming president of Ukraine that no senior U.S. official would attend his inauguration and vital U.S. military aid would be withheld if an investigation into Biden were not announced. Parnas appeared on MSNBC with Rachel Maddow.
President Trump knew exactly what was going on. He was aware of all of my movements. I wouldn't do anything without the consent of Rudy Giuliani or the president.
The new accusation came as House Democrats made public a trove of documents, text messages, and photos from Parnas' smartphones that appeared to verify parts of his account. Six national organizations who say they represent millions of progressive activists have joined forces to issue a unity statement in the wake of the controversy over a two-year-old meeting between presidential candidates Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. The two have differed over whether Sanders told Warren a woman couldn't beat Donald Trump. The progressive groups say the surest way to defeat Trump is for the Democratic Party to nominate either Warren or Sanders, as they're the best candidates able to energize voters by providing a vision of a decent society and a fair economy. Their statement says that Sanders and Warren, as well as their campaigns and supporters, will need to find ways to cooperate. It adds, quote, the crossfire amplified by the media is unhelpful and does not reflect the relationship between two Senate colleagues who broadly worked well together for most of the last year. The signing organizations are Our Revolution, the Sunrise Movement, and RootsAction.org, all of which support Sanders, the Working Families Party, which supports Warren, and Justice Democrats and Democracy for America, which currently do not support any presidential candidate. Two U.S. agencies say the decade that just ended was by far the hottest ever measured on Earth, capped off by the second warmest year on record. Scientists say there's no doubt that it's all due to human activity. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration said the 2010s averaged 1.4 degrees Celsius higher than the 20th century average and more than one-third of a degree warmer than the previous decade, which had itself been the hottest on record. Omar Badur is a senior scientist with the World Meteorological Association, which has urged dramatic action to address the climate crisis.
Heat waves, floods that have impacted droughts, that have impacted people around the world in terms of migration of people because of drought, in terms of internal displacement because of floods. Wildfires have been also one of the most noticeable events during 2019, even in areas where fires are very rare, like in the Arctic region.
Virginia's Democratic Governor Ralph Northam says he's declaring a state of emergency over threats from militia groups ahead of a gun rights rally next week. The emergency order will ban weapons of all kinds, including firearms. Northam says some of the rhetoric used by groups planning to attend the rally is similar to what was said in the lead-up to the deadly 2017 white nationalist rally in Charlottesville. I'm Eileen Alfandary for Pacifica Radio.
And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to go right into our weekly Earth Watch. In British Columbia, Canada's westernmost province, First Nations people are leading a struggle to defend their environment against the Coastal GasLink pipeline. The project being pushed by Calgary-based company TC Energy has the stated goal of moving natural gas from northeastern British Columbia to the coast, where a liquefied natural gas plant is set for construction. But as members of the indigenous Wet'suwet'en Nation have pointed out, the pipeline not only presents dangers to the environment, it also violates their territorial sovereignty. Coastal Gas Link has reportedly violated the law to trespass on indigenous land and has bulldozed through their territories, destroying archaeological sites and occupying their land with industrial sites. To make matters worse, private security firms and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police have continually harassed Wet'suwet'en people defending their lands. I would like to welcome our guest, Molly Wickham. She is a Gedemtan clan member adopted into the Grizzly Bear House. Molly's father is descended from the Frog Clan. Her matrilineal ancestors have been intermarried into the Wet'suwet'en since the early 1900s and have lived on that land since that time. She completed her undergraduate degree on Coast Salish territories at the University of Victoria in sociology and went on to earn a master's degree in Indigenous governance. After completing university, Molly moved home with her family to learn more about land, culture, and traditional governance. She currently lives on the Yinta with her family and is passionate about governance, the health and well-being of the Yinta territories, and the transmission of culture, language, and traditional song and dance. Molly, welcome.
Good morning.
Okay, and we also want to thank the Global Justice Ecology Project. We partner with them for our weekly Earth Watch. So, Molly, start by telling us just a bit of the history, because this protection of the land of the Wet'suwet'en, that was fought in the courts for many years. And back in 1997, the Supreme Court in Canada ruled in favor of the Wet'suwet'en people. So what's going on right now?
That's right. So in 1997, the Supreme Court ruled that the Wet'suwet'en and the Gikxan, our neighbors, had never ceded or surrendered, had never extinguished title to our territories, and that it was our hereditary chiefs, because we still maintain our traditional governance system, that have full jurisdiction over 22,000 square kilometers of territory. And so that decision is being ignored in the courts with the most recent injunction that's come down, and which actually just the injunction process itself is quite racist against Indigenous people, and it's designed to basically benefit industry.
Yeah, and really a land grab. Tell us about the impact on the environment, but also the traditional life for Indigenous people, as you know, if this project moves forward.
Right. So the pipeline route, and this is the first proposed of up to 13 that have been proposed through our territory, and every single one of them converges at one point in the territory, and that's right underneath our headwaters of all of our river systems. We call that river Wudzinkwa. In English, it's the Maurice River, but it flows into all our major salmon spawning rivers, and it's one of the the headwaters of one of our major salmon spawning rivers where all of our salmon go to spawn. And so environmentally, it could mean the end of our salmon, the end of a lot of our sacred sites. But it's also impacting already, even in its pre-construction stages, how we can access our territory. We're being criminalized so that we can't practice our traditions. I live out on the territory with my family. I have two small children, and we practice a traditional life. So we hunt and we gather our food, and we're out on the territory all the time. And it's had a huge impact on how we can live our lives already, just to date.
Right. And tell us then the ways in which you and your supporters have been resisting, hoping to really stop this project.
Well, there's a village, an Unistoten village, and that's my father clan, and they have had their village going for about 10 years now, where people are occupying their territory. And so since that time, they've built a huge healing center so that people can come out and heal from the trauma of colonization. And so they've been in existence about 20 kilometers away from where our current village is. And then my clan, Gidimben, after the injunction order came, the temporary injunction came last year, started up a camp about 20 kilometers down the road. And that's where we saw the invasion of our camp by militarized RCMP last year. And then also another RCMP detachment that actually was constructed on our territory without the consent of us.
Right, and I see the Indigenous Environmental Network. They have made a call for people to go to the land and to support, and particularly for Indigenous people, and if Indigenous people need help being able to go to show support, they're inviting people to contact the Indigenous Environmental Network. So these kinds of support activities in terms of people just coming to the camp, but also what are some of the other ways that people could lend solidarity to the fight you all are making?
There's many ways. There's quite a few different ways that we have on our website. So we have a website that's called yintaaccess.com.
Yeah, could you repeat that?
Yintaaccess, it's Yintah, access.com. And Yinta means our land and everything in it. So it includes the water, the air, the animals, which is what we're fighting for. And we have a lot of different ways listed on there as how people can come and support. So whether with their physical bodies, we have some human rights observers coming legally, financially, and for people to be occupying their territories and putting pressure on the investors and the governments as well.
Right.
Because so we see this fight as bigger than just us as one nation within, you know, so-called Canada. This is really a struggle for Indigenous sovereignty and Indigenous rights globally.
Absolutely. And what we will do, Molly Wickham, we will post the website on our social media, and we hope to keep following this particular story and this particular struggle, a frontline community, at the time that there is so much devastation and so much fear about what will happen to the planet. We want to thank you for joining us on the show and letting us know what's going on, and also to you and all of the people there for the work that they're doing, because we know it. You are defending your land and territory, but this is really also a defense of the earth itself. So we appreciate that. Thank you for joining us, Molly Wickham.
Thank you.
All righty. On December 12, 2019, the United Kingdom, the UK, held one of its most consequential general elections in recent history that shifted its political landscape. Not only did it confirm the country's controversial departure from the European Union, known as Brexit, it was also one of the biggest wins for the British right in decades. For the Conservatives, the election resulted in a landslide majority win of 80 seats, their largest majority since 1987, back when right-wing Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher was in power. They made a net gain of 48 seats, and Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who was backed by Donald Trump, won 43.6% of the vote, compared to Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn's 32.2%. In England, the Conservatives won 345 out of 533 seats, penetrating Labour's historic base in the north, known to many as the Red Wall. Across this area, most of the seats had not had a Conservative Member of Parliament since late last century. Labour, on the other hand, won 202 seats, making it their worst result in a general election since 1935 in terms of seats. Shortly after, Jeremy Corbyn announced plans to resign as leader of the Labour Party, and there are now five candidates who are hoping to be able to replace him. The Labour leadership ballot will run from February 21st to April 2nd, and results will be announced on Saturday, April 4th. The party will also elect a new deputy leader. Meanwhile, on Friday, January 31st, the UK will officially leave the European Union 47 years after it joined the European Economic Community in 1973. Let us, before we welcome our guests, let us go to hear a clip we'll be hearing from two of the candidates who are hoping to replace Jeremy Corbyn as head of the Labour Party. One is Sir Keir Starmer, who is dubbed soft left. We'll see if our guest agrees with that. And also Rebecca Long-Bailey, who has the support of Momentum, which is a grassroots movement, not in the Labour Party, but was in support of Jeremy Corbyn. And she's talking about Corbyn and anti-Semitism. Of course, the charge of anti-Semitism was broadly used against and wrongfully used against Jeremy Corbyn. Let's go to those clips and then we'll go to our guests.
We cannot fight the Tories if we're fighting each other. Factionalism has to go. The question should not be, which side are you on? It should be, what are you saying? We have Johnson as our Prime Minister. Boris Johnson as our Prime Minister. Takes some getting used to. Boris Johnson. The man of no principles, no moral compass, who will go anywhere to stay in power, and his party is going to the right, and he will go to the right. He has a majority, but he does not have a license to do damage to our communities and damage to our countries, and it's our job to hold him to account and to be a very, very effective opposition. Jeremy Corbyn made our party the party of anti-austerity, and he was right to do so. The party that would fight cuts to public services. He made us the party that wanted to invest more heavily in our public services, and he was right to do so. And we must retain that. We build on that, we don't trash it as we go forward. We have to show we're the party of the Green New Deal, where we no longer have the question or the debate, well, it's good for the economy but bad for the environment. Not anymore. If it's bad for the environment, it's bad for the economy.
Emily Thornberry was asked to rate Jeremy Corbyn's dealing of anti-Semitism. She gave it 2 out of 10. What would you give it?
I wouldn't give anything a rating. I mean, it's not...
Well, you gave him a rating of 10 out of 10.
It's not Todd Trump's. It's too serious to give ratings. We didn't tackle the issue. It's as simple as that. We have lost trust within the Jewish community. They don't believe that we're tackling anti-Semitism. And talking about small numbers of our members being involved in it and saying that it's not a big issue isn't good enough, because if you don't tackle the problem, you don't have robust processes in place, and we haven't worked with Jewish communal organisations, then we've not done our job.
Does Jeremy Corbyn bear personal responsibility for it?
He does, and he's apologised. And I think any Labour politician that leads the Labour Party should apologise again for what has happened, because it has been unacceptable.
Okay, I'd now like to welcome back to Sojourner Truth Sam Weinstein, retired official from the National Office of the Utility Workers Union of America, now based in London. He's active with Camden Branch of Momentum, a regional grassroots network arising out of the movement following the Jeremy Corbyn for Labour leader campaign. He's also a member of Payday Men's Network, an international and multiracial network of men which works with the global women's strike. Sam Weinstein, welcome back.
Thank you, Margaret.
Okay, so Sam...
I'm not sure the circumstances are great, but we do the best we can with what we've got.
Yeah, and Sam, I mean, let's start with this whole, you know, you just heard the clip in which Rebecca Long-Bailey talked about Jeremy Corbyn apologizing. Apparently, she has also agreed to some demands from the Zionist lobby in the UK in adopting their definition of anti-Semitism, which is opposed by pro-Palestinians, a prevention of pro-Palestinians like Ken Livingstone from re-entering the party after their expulsion, the expulsion of Labour members who give a platform to those who've been expelled for anti-Semitism, letting the pro-Israel Jewish Labour movement deliver anti-racism education, engaging the Jewish community only through pro-Israel organizations. So, Sam, there we have it. One result of the loss here. Your comment on the role that this charge against Jeremy Corbyn played in the election and the election result, and now it's still ongoing, given it looks like the caving of a woman who may replace Jeremy Corbyn. Sam Weinstein.
Indeed. And I think Keir Starmer has also agreed to the 10 demands, the 10 commandments, as they're being called here, from the Board of Deputies of British Jews, who are well-known Tories, so that we, in fact...
And Tories meaning conservatives.
Conservative Party. That's right. We have the Conservative Party dictating to the Labour Party, to officials of the Labour Party, how they should behave and what the policy should be in relation to anti-Semitism and anti-racism generally, which is just outrageous and has many of us just holding our heads and wondering what to do. I mean, it has become quite something. But in terms of...
What happened?
What effect...
Yeah.
Yeah, well, the effect, the actual effect of the... witch hunt on anti-Semitism, because you can't call it any less than that. The number of people who have actually been expelled from Labour for anti-Semitism is less than 10 or 15, something like that. In a party that's 500,000, it's really minuscule. I think it's 0.06 of the membership. Which is really extraordinarily small, and some of it we do have to remember that Johnson himself about Jewish oligarchs. But only Labour has gotten this. The real problem was that Jeremy Corbyn never, and the leadership of the Labour Party never drew a line under the old Blairites, the old right wing of the Labour Party, and as a result of that, he was unable to defend us, because that was what the anti-Semitism was used for. It was used by the right wing to attack the left wing.
Yeah.
But I think we do have to be careful and not get too sidetracked by that in terms of what the result was. The result of the election was very much tied to Brexit.
Mm-hmm.
The particular... seats that Labour lost, 52 out of the 54, were in constituencies where people had overwhelmingly voted for Brexit and were really, frankly, very angry that the results of their vote were going to be taken away by Labour, which was proposing another referendum. And that did not happen in 2017, because in 2017, Labour stuck to the position that they would live by the results of the referendum, but they would negotiate a deal that preserved all the good things that we were getting from Europe. So once the transition had taken place, these people felt that they had really been betrayed, and that's what you see when you look at the statistics. The other statistics, which are very interesting and worth keeping in mind, is that young people overwhelmingly voted Labour, and people over 65 overwhelmingly voted Tory. Maybe that's not a shock. I'm sure if you went and looked at the statistics for the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, they'd probably be similar. But these were really extraordinarily overwhelming. There wouldn't have been a single Tory elected if it had been up to people under 25, not one, which gives you some idea of how lopsided it was. I also think you have to really keep in mind the extraordinary assault that was made on Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour leadership from the press, all sections of the press.
Yeah.
You normally could count on certain papers like The Mirror and The Guardian to support the Labour leadership in general and to support a Labour victory. That did not really happen in this election. All the way through the election, they kept on repeating the anti-Semitism charges and various other charges, that he wasn't a strong leader, that Jeremy wasn't a strong leader, one thing or another. But the fact of the matter is, none of that was true, but it was an insistent refrain from the press. So these are some of the things that you have to keep in mind. One of the things that I think is important for your listeners to understand, by the way, is it was the most progressive manifesto and program that the Labour Party had ever put out in many, many, in generations. And that is not the reason that they lost, as you can tell by what happened in Scotland. In Scotland, the Scottish National Party won seats away from Labour and practically swept the board from the Tories and everybody else, and their platform was equally, if not more, left-wing than the Labour Party platform, to the extent that they called for the abandonment of the nuclear deterrent in Scotland, the Trident. They wanted to get rid of it and to take that money and to use it for social programs, which was even more than the Labour Party was proposing. So that they won an overwhelming majority in Scotland. So you can see that the manifesto was not the problem. The problem really was people didn't want their vote on Brexit to be nullified.
Yeah, and in reading some analysis, I think it was actually something written in the BBC news about what U.S. Democrats can learn from Labour's U.K. election defeat. I mean, quoting some of the people on election night, Labour supporters who were quite dejected, one of them said, a 37-year-old said, Tories are better at exploiting the fear of voters. And then, you know, there's a lot of talk about looking at the kind of cultural fears that people have. I was reading something with somebody going on about that in the UK, and that was ignored by Labour, and that the Democrats here shouldn't make the same mistake. And they were also saying things like progressive parties ignore the new politics of culture and identity at their peril. And, you know, so this kind of talk about cultural anxiety, you know, how much do you think that played a role in what happened?
Well, I often think that the culture stuff is an excuse for racism, frankly.
Absolutely, that's what it is.
and there's no that in. Just as the Rust Belt exists in the United States, in the Midwest, and Appalachia, and so on, there is a Rust Belt in the north of England, and they have been treated abominably and have been robbed of resources, etc., etc. And very often you find in those situations that there's a lot of an attempt to blame, quote, foreigners, and those can be white foreigners from Europe, or they can be people of color from all over the Commonwealth and all over the world. And so there's no question that some of that soaked in. But you found very often that, in fact, in some of these towns which were heavily Brexit and were doing a racist vote, there were very few people who were not English. That, in fact, it was a complete mythology. And I would point on the other hand, which I think is really important to keep in mind, that my mother was recently in hospital. And it was extraordinary because we have the National Health Service in this country, so she didn't have to pay, she didn't have to fill out any insurance forms or anything like that. But the people who were running the hospital, the doctors, the nurses, orderlies, anybody who was helping out in any way, it was such a mix from all over the world. It was unbelievable. English people, people who had been born in England or born in the UK, were very much a minority, and all of these people worked together with extraordinary ease. So there was no, there is no problem of culture,
yeah,
as such. I mean, it really is a mythology. It was really amazing, and you could see that people were working their asses off, if I may be so crude, because the National Health Service has been extraordinarily underfunded under two Tory governments. And so it's really in trouble now, and it's likely to be under even more trouble under Boris Johnson.
Right, and Sam...
They work together.
Right. Sam, we just have a few minutes left. There's so much to unpack here. We'll have to return to this. But just in terms of what is happening now, on the one hand, the Labour Party is saying that their membership has surged by about 60,000 since the election, and that much of that has to do with people wanting to tamper or tame the more progressive part of labor in a more moderate direction. So I wonder if you think that that is true. And also, on the other hand, the movement, how the movement is reacting in terms of a progressive movement, really taking the blows of the defeat, but is it continuing to build? And then there is organized labor. There is a Lisa Nandy, who's one of the candidates to replace Jeremy Corbyn, and she is being backed by the National Union of Mine Workers. So I suppose as you're looking at these five candidates, you know, so a lot of that is being sorted. Just your final thoughts now on what has happened, now the election has happened and everybody's taken a look at it, and how things are moving forward with both Labour as well as the progressive movement in the UK. Sam Weinstein.
Yeah, well, everybody seems to agree that this is really going to be a fight between Rebecca Long Bailey, who is the quote left candidate.
She's backed by Momentum.
So to speak, the inheritor. She's backed by Momentum, but also she stuck with Corbyn through thick and thin and was always a supporter of hers. The agreeing to the Board of Deputies' Ten Commandments was unfortunate, but I think people on the left are generally committed to voting for her. The other candidate who is likely, who has a real shot at it, is Keir Starmer, who's a former prosecutor. He was head of the what they call the CPS, the grouping here that decides on which cases to take to court for prosecution. And we, in fact, have had, I volunteer at the Women's Center here in Kentish Town, and Women Against Rape came up against him when he was in office, at the CPS, and he refused to stop prosecuting women who were putting complaints in about rape that the police didn't believe. They didn't believe the women, and then they prosecuted the women, which of course made women very cautious about whether or not they were going to complain about rapists.
Outrageous,
So totally outrageous. And there have been a number of other complaints about Keir Starmer's past. And he is clearly the centrist candidate, even though he is saying, as in the clip you played, that he's going to stick by a lot of the Corbyn agenda. Many of us have little faith that that will happen.
Yeah, well, so he also said you can't say which side are you on, but what are you saying? I mean, what the hell is that? Right?
What does that mean?
Yeah.
It means nothing, and we expect that he's a good lawyer, and he will tackle it from that point of view.
Yeah.
The unions are likely to break up among a series of different candidates. So Lisa Nandy has one there. Each of the candidates is likely to end up with some union supporting them. But when it comes right down to it, it is going to be a membership vote. And in all likelihood, it will be between Long Bailey and Keir Starmer.
Right. Well, Sam Wines, I'm afraid... Okay, I'm afraid we are going to have to leave it there. There are a couple of women waiting to talk about the Women's March. That's going to be coming up across the U.S. and somebody also joining us about the Poor People's Campaign, the Reverend Dr. William Barber, who will be in the Inland Empire in Southern California. But Sam Weinstein, thank you so very much for being with us. And we'll have you back to continue this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Margaret.
All right, we're going to take a really short station break, and coming up, Gina Belafonte, Emiliana Goreka, waiting to speak with us about the Women's March. All right, that's Beyonce, the sister who run the world. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're also on Facebook. You can like and friend us on Facebook, and our handle on Twitter and Instagram at SoTrueRadio. And we are across the nation and worldwide on SoundCloud. And today we'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Mountain View, California. And internationally, we'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the United Arab Emirates, the UAE. We're now going to turn our attention to the Women's March. We've got a few of the organizers with us on the phone. We'd like to welcome them. We'd like to welcome native New Yorker, now based here in Southern California, I think, Gina Belafonte, who spent her life in the arenas of entertainment and activism, where her professional work thrives today. She is the executive director of Sankofa.org, a social justice organization that enlists the support of today's artists and influential individuals in collaboration with grassroots partners to elevate the voices of the disenfranchised and promote peace, justice, and equality. Gina Belafonte, welcome back. It's been too long. Welcome, Gina.
Thank you so much, Margaret, for having me.
Right, and I'm sure some of our listeners recognize that last name. I'll say no more than that, Gina. I'm sure you get that way too often, right? The daughter of. And also with us, I'd like to welcome Emiliana Goreka. And Emiliana is an entrepreneur based in Los Angeles with a passion for giving back to the community. She's an award-winning event producer. Emmy, as we call her, devotes much of her time to advocacy programs for women's rights, Latino education, and gender equality. She brings her 10 plus years of event experience to the Women's March LA. And in 2016, I think it was, Emmy, you founded the Women's March LA Foundation, which is a nonprofit organization and actually is its own entity apart from the National Women's March organization. Emmy, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
So, Emmy, tell us what's going to be going on this Saturday.
Well, we are marching. We are marching Saturday morning from Pershing Square to City Hall. We are expecting about 250,000 people to take to the street.
Wow.
We are focusing on voting. We are focusing on women rising. We firmly believe that 2020 is a critical election, if not the most critical of our lifetime. We believe that women will elect the next president of the United States, so we need to mobilize and continue with this movement.
Yes, and Gina, I just remember last year being there at the march, and the program was so tight. It moved very, very smoothly. The music was incredible. Actually, I had a hard time heading out from the march because I was busy dancing along with so many others. So in a way, it was very serious in terms of women's rights and the issues women are concerned about and still facing. But it was also celebratory. And you play a role in all of that, Gina. So what can we expect this year?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things that we're doing this year that's different from the past is you'll see some different faces on the stage taking to the mic to share some of the work and the passions that they have been working on over this past year. And as Emiliana said, we're really focusing on the vote and giving platform to many of the organizers that the Women's March Los Angeles Foundation has been working with throughout this, not only this last year, but consistently through the last 4 years. And a lot of voices that we haven't heard, but of course we will still have music. We will have the arts having a very big presence down there. We'll have two large art installations for people to take selfies with that have beautiful messaging around our LGBTQ family and our other immigrant family. We'll have the Ray Chu Band will be out again, so we'll have music, because I think we have to celebrate as women. We also have to celebrate as organizers. It's important that we find balance in this movement and to share some of our wins and our joys. But let's not be mistaken, this is a very, very critical election coming up, and we do have to focus, and we have to come together in a common agenda on how we are going to make a shift in this country in the positive direction.
Yes, and Emmy, just very quickly, you know, there's been some controversy around the Women's March nationally and some changes on the board. We were just on with Sam Weinstein based in the UK and talking about how a charge of anti-Semitism was used against Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn, wrongfully so. We know that some of that came up in terms of national Women's March. But it sounds as though from what you're saying, despite the efforts to attack or undermine the march, that you're still expecting great numbers and great support. And it's interesting that the largest demonstrations that have happened in this country since the election of Donald Trump, beginning with the day after his election, have been the women's marches. Emmy, some final thoughts from you.
Well, I want to say that, you know, it's part of our tagline, Women Rising. Yes, there are efforts to undermine women, to undermine women that are putting forth the work. Historically, the Women's March has been the largest protest in the United States, even at its lowest numbers, according to New York Times and Washington Post. I think that a lot of the new congressional seats were won because of Women's March. I think that five presidential candidates, female women running for presidency, was all due to Women's March. So we are a very new organization. If we think about it, this is only our third year as an organization. And so we, you know, there's baby steps. We have a lot of learning to do, but we're not going to go away. We are still continuing with the fight for women's rights because in 2020, it's more critical than ever.
Yeah, and just a quick final thought from you, Gina Belafonte. You come from a family clearly with a long history of social justice, of anti-racism, civil rights, and much more. And also, I imagine you are involved with the Women's March because you're still seeing a strong social justice component to Women Rising and what the Women's March is hoping to do. Gina?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, going deep into this work and in organizing, we see so many women at the forefront of this movement and all social justice movements, whether it's the Poor People's Campaign, whether it's Planned Parenthood, whether it is immigration rights. Women are really taking a deep leadership role. And what we really need to do is to align with each other so that we can support each other's work and continue to make inroads. And while this presidency is so deeply critical, 2 years after that, we're going to have another election, and it's going to be critical again. So all elections, people need to find their voice and the space and the place where they can get articulated and understand the issues and really vote their morality and their conscience with love.
Right. And Emmy, where should women turn up on Saturday? Where and when?
Women should turn up at 9 a.m. at Pershing Square, 532 South Olive. We will have sign making, some music, a short speaking program, and then we're marching 1.2 miles to City Hall.
Right, and that's not only women, but of course men and all the supporters of women. Well, I certainly hope to be there, and I want to thank both of you for the work that you've done and you're continuing to do. Thank you so very much. All the best.
Thank you for having us, Margaret. Thank you so much for giving us this platform.
Sure. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Now, many of you have heard me talk about the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. And what I want to do before hearing from our final guests of today, I'd like to go to a short clip, because the Poor People's Campaign was outside the last presidential debate in Iowa protesting, because they have been demanding, I should say we have been demanding, that there be a debate on poverty. Let's hear from the Reverend William Barber. I think he's marching here as he makes this point.
Our silence is not symbolic of who we are, but an ugly metaphor for how silent this nation has been on the issue of poverty, while people are dying, 600 a day, 140 million poor and low-wealth people are demanding that they be heard. We've not had a debate in over 28 debates addressing the issue facing 43% of this nation. And in Iowa alone, over a million people, because 600 people need a casket today who died from the effects of poverty.
Just devastating here. I'd like to welcome 600 people dying each day from the result of poverty. The Bishop Emory B. James was called to the ministry in 1975. He organized his current pastorate, Ephesians New Testament Church, which he has successfully served as pastor for nearly 30 years. They've been doing a lot of social justice work. Bishop Emory James also served as the president of the Fontana Ministerial Association and organized a feeding program called Fontana We Care, an assisted living facility called the Olive Branch Transitional Housing Project in the city of Fontana. He has received numerous awards for outstanding service to the county of San Bernardino, the city of Fontana, and the state of California overall for community service. Welcome, Bishop Emory B. James.
Thank you, Ms. Prescott. I'm honored to be on your show this morning.
So you are going to be welcoming Dr. William Barber. Tell us where and when and why.
Okay, Ephesians New Testament Church is going to host the 32nd Annual Martin Luther King Jr. Celebration, January 18, 2020. Location is going to be the Westside Baptist Church, 15006 Randall Avenue in Fontana at 3 p.m. As you know, this is the Dr. King season, and Dr. King is worthy to be celebrated. And we felt that bringing Dr. Barber in, who has articulated and revived the movement of the poor people, we thought that in order to celebrate Dr. King properly this year, we could not overlook the Poor People's Campaign and the work that Dr. William Barber has done. And William Barber, most of you know, is president of Repairs of the Breach, Poor People's Campaign on Washington, is scheduled for a major march June 20th, 2020. And he's the former president of the North Carolina NAACP. If you've never heard Dr. Barber, we have found him to be an electrifying speaker and has become the voice of the civil rights movement of this in this country in this day and time. And so we wanted to bring him to celebrate Dr. King and to help him revitalize the poor people's campaign and movement and march on Washington by calling focus to this. My church has always been in the forefront of celebrating Dr. King. When I first came to Fontana in 1979, Fontana was really in bad shape because we had the Klan and we had the Hell's Angels riding up and down the street, but we have moved this community to celebrating Dr. King's birthday, and we have a library named after him, we have a statue after him, and we were able to elect our first African-American mayor in the name of Aquanetta Warren. So we've done a lot of work here in this community to bring awareness to the spirit and the movement of Dr. King, and we just felt that latching on to this poor people's campaign movement with Dr. Barber would be the best way to associate and celebrate Dr. King's birthday on January 18th.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you, and thank you, Bishop Emery James. I find Dr. Barber as the real deal, the inspiration that he gives, the energy he puts out, not only when he speaks, but he's also an organizer. And for full clarity here, disclosure, I am active with the Poor People's Campaign, a part of the coordinator group in California, and will be in Washington, D.C. June 2020. And we're hoping that across the nation, there'll be 100,000 of us with this new civil rights movement, this fusion movement. So, Bishop James, I'm so excited to meet you this way on radio and to know about the incredible work you have done in Fontana, because a lot of people talk about Martin Luther King and his memory, but you're one of those people that are actually continuing and carrying out the work of Dr. King. I don't know.
Well, many have various opinions about the dream of Dr. King, which continually is analyzed and interpreted just to meet the diverse opinions that challenge the world today.
Yeah.
I believe that what keeps the dream alive is the fact that it can never be placed in a box nor made infinitely interpreted simply because it continues to evolve, and it's always calling us to a loftier place in humanitarianism.
Absolutely.
And so this is the reason that after 50 years, the dream is still as fresh as it was the first day the arrow of moral vicissitude and it was released, and it pierced the heart and moved us to repent from the immoral spirit of selfish indignation. So my movement here in Fontana is to keep that dream alive and to keep it active for young people and for people that are young adults. And so we try to put things together here in Fontana celebrating his birthday that keep that on their mind and let them know they have a moral responsibility to make sure that the principles of nonviolence and activism continue. And so Dr. Barber is a proponent of that. He is an extension of what Dr. King was.
And so
we want to celebrate him, and we want to do things that's going to bring focus to this experience of Dr. King, and he is the ideal person, especially with the Poor People's Campaign movement. I was in San Francisco a month ago for that march, and I'm telling you, it was phenomenal.
It was something else. Bishop Emery James, I'm so sad because what you're saying is beautifully said. We're out of time on the show. I've got to dash out of the studio, but we'll have you back, though. We'll have you back, and we have information about your event up on our social media. Thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on your show. I have enjoyed this moment together. Thank you.
Okay. If you'd like a copy of today's show, contact the Pacifica Radio Archives. I want to thank Mr. T. Teddy Robinson, our engineer, Ramiro Funes, our engineer, our assistant producer. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
Hard in my brother, and it's gone on for too long. Oh, it's gone on.
I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
I'm Shahid Hamid, KBOO board member. Join the World Arts Foundation and KBOO Radio as we pay homage to the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. It's the 35th anniversary of Keep Alive the Dream, Monday, January the 20th from 11 to 6:30 p.m. at the Highland Christian Center. This year, we will be joined by international opera star Angela Brown and straight from America's Got Talent, Danielle Damon. That's Monday, January the 20th from 11 to 6:30 p.m. at the Highland Christian Center at 7600 Northeast Gleason. Or listen live on KBOO Radio or view it on Open Signal Community Television.
KBOO Community Radio is working with Beautiful Portland to collect socks and blankets for those who are sleeping outside this winter. There is a collection box in the lobby of KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, between Burnside and Ankeny. Donations are accepted Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. And next up, we've got Veterans Voice. Marvin is here. And we're going to start with some music. Stand by.
We pay in hell since Moscow burned. Cossacks tear us piece by piece. Our dead are strewn 100 leagues. Oh, death would be a sweet relief. And our grand army is dressed in rags. A frozen, starving beggar band. Like rats, we steal each other's scraps. Fighting hand to hand. Save my soul from evil, Lord, and heal this soldier's heart. I'll trust in thee to keep me, Lord. I'm